CPRC. What is it? The Crime Prevention Research Center is what it is, and it's founded by our next guest, Dr. John Lott Jr. He's an economist and a world-recognized expert on guns and crime. It's kind of funny. You know, what's an economist do? Talking about guns. He's held research or teaching positions at various academic institutions from the University of Chicago to Yale University and many in between. He is a current contributor and a continual contributor, Fox News, the Hill newspaper, townhall.com. He has a piece in Newsweek that we're going to talk about probably at the beginning of the interview here. It's really exciting to have Dr. Lott on, a new guest of the Power Hour. Dr. Lott, welcome to the Power Hour.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yes, you've written a new article here lately about this election and what you see in it. Let's just hit it right there. Let's go right to that. Why is this so important?
Well, I think this election is going to determine the future of private gun ownership in the United States. I really think that this is the most important election that we've ever had on that issue, and it's going to affect a lot of other things. And it focuses a lot on the Democrats' promise to get rid of the filibuster. Biden, Kamala Harris, Chuck Schumer have all said that they're talking about getting rid of the filibuster. And that may seem like an arcane rule to lots of people, but it's going to fundamentally change how the government passes laws if they keep their promise on this. So what the filibuster allows senators to essentially prevent votes on legislation and allows them to talk. You know, people may remember the old movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington type thing with Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart, yeah.
And what you have to have is 60 votes in order to end debate on a bill. And so it requires bipartisan support. No party is going to have 60 votes in the Senate. And in order to pass legislation, you have to have at least a few votes from the other party to get something through. If they get rid of the filibuster, the House and the Senate will essentially function the same way, where you can just have simple party line votes for whatever party's in the majority, pass legislation. And there's a whole range of different types of bills that the Democrats and Biden and others have promised on guns. You know, things like they would allow lawsuits against gun makers and gun sellers whenever their product is used improperly. If you have somebody committing a crime with a gun, or it's accidentally discharged, or you know, somebody commits suicide, then either those people or the relatives of those individuals would be able to go and sue the gun companies and the sellers for damages, you know, health care, as well as lost wages, pain and suffering, other things. I mean, could you imagine if you had that type of rule for cars? I mean, we have 4.5 million people a year who are injured in car accidents. If each of those individuals could go and bring a lawsuit, or their relatives could go and bring a lawsuit against the car makers. You know, we're not talking about product liability. We're not talking about the cars malfunctioning. We're talking about a driver getting into an accident there and causing some harm. You know, it would drive the car companies out of business. And that's pretty much the point, I believe, of that type of bill that they're promising to get through. But we can go through, I mean, they have literally like 15 different gun control bills that they're promising to get through. But there's a more fundamental change that's going to happen here if they get rid of the filibuster. The first bill that Biden's promising to bring up when he becomes president is to give citizenship to the 22 million plus illegal aliens in the country so that they can vote. He's promising to have other changes, like give statehood to D.C. and Puerto Rico, which would give Democrats four more seats in the Senate. They're promising to ban states that have photo ID requirements for voting. You know, there's a whole range of things that I think are going to fundamentally change the balance of power in Washington and make it so that the Republicans are unlikely to win elections again in the near future, or at least the Republican Party as it's currently constituted. And I think it'd be really huge change. And of course, the courts, I mean, it's just not legislation that they're going to pass in elections. One of the things that they're likely to do is to change the number of judges who are on the different courts. The last time we had a big increase in the number of judges on the courts was the Carter administration, which is when the Democrats had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. Because, I mean, right now, if you have a Republican Senate or a Republican president, Democrats in the Senate aren't going to vote to let the Republican have a lot more vacancies on the courts to fill. If you have a Democrat president, Republicans aren't going to do that. And so if you get rid of the filibuster, you won't need to get members of the other party to agree to have that type of increase. You know, people talk about the 53 circuit court judges that Trump's been able to put on the bench, and he's had an impact, but he's just been able to go and bring the courts into rough balance. The Democrats still control the circuit courts for 24 states and the District of Columbia, which is by far the second most important circuit court because it handles all the regulatory issues in the country. But by increasing the number of judges on these courts, they will quickly be able to go and give Democrat majorities on all the circuit courts.
You are one of the most referenced researchers in the world, in the country, certainly, you know, if not the world. I mean, people respect you when you come up with a statistics or research. I mean, it's, oh, whoa, Dr. Lott did it. Let's look at this. Let me ask, I'm sitting here as an armchair political analyst or observing these polls about Biden. They tell me that Biden is 5 points ahead of Trump. Now, I'm just looking at this from what I see. I look around the nation. I look at the rallies that Trump did. I look at the rallies that Biden's doing where he can't even fill a small gymnasium. I think about the last election with Hillary. It's kind of the same talk. I mean, you're a world-class researcher. Are those polls accurate or are my lying eyes telling me something different?
I think there's a lot of noise in the polls. There's a lot of issues that we can talk about. One is, what types of voters are they looking at? Are they looking at likely voters or registered voters? Most polls at this point in time are looking at registered voters, not likely voters. And registered voters tend to be more Democrat than likely voters. And that can add, you know, 3%, 4%, 5% onto the totals that are there. Usually they don't go to likely voters until you get to a couple weeks before the election because, you know, maybe only half the registered voters that you survey are going to be likely voters. And so in order to get a large enough sample of likely voters, you have to survey a lot more people because you have to throw out a lot of the responses that you get because you're not going to use registered voters who are not likely voters in figuring out what your sample is going to be. And that means a lot more phone calls and is more costly. So they tend to use registered voters to begin with. The other thing is, how do you weight the sample? How do you make decisions on what percent of voters you think are going to be Democrats, what percent are going to be different age groups, what percent are going to be college educated or not? And there's a lot of guesswork on that. So, for example, I may go and do a survey, and let's say 60% of the people that I get in my sample are men and 40% are women. But I know that men aren't going to make up 60% of the voters. They may make up 47% of the voters. And so I have to, what they call weighted, give, you know, essentially use that 60% that I have for guys and just say, okay, let's just assume that they'll only make up 40% of the voters that are there. Well, you can have huge impacts on what your final results are going to be depending upon, you know, do you believe that men are going to be 47% or 52% of the voters or something like that? Or, you know, the same issues occur when you're talking about political affiliation, when you're talking about age, or when you're talking about education. Are 50% of the voters going to be college educated, or is it going to be 60%? So, you know, those are big issues. And in the 2016 election, it was pretty clear that the pollsters had made some really big errors in terms of their assumptions about of the weights that they were going to give to different groups. And, you know, whether they're doing that again, you know, who knows? I mean, part of the problem also is people's refusal to go and answer questions. You have to guess. Is it one particular group versus another who's more likely to be reticent to go and talk to pollsters?
So it sounds like in these research, and especially polls like this, that there's a lot more subjectivity than maybe we would believe at first.
Yeah, there's a lot. There is guesswork. You know, it's just they can kind of look at past elections to try to guess that weighting. But I'll give you an example. So in the 2016 election, they assumed that blacks were going to be voting at the same rate in 2016 as they did in 2008 and 2012. Well, that wasn't the case. I mean, when you didn't have Obama at the top of the ticket, when you had Hillary Clinton, blacks didn't show up at the same rate to vote as they had when Obama was running. You know, maybe one of the reasons why Biden has chosen Kamala Harris to be on the ticket to try to increase that, for example. But, you know, who knows whether, I mean, my own guess is that's not going to have the same effect that having Obama on the ticket had. You know, how do you guess? Do you look at the black turnout rate in 2016? Do you look at the black turnout rate in 2012? Do you pick out something in between those two? There's a lot of guesswork that's there.
I've heard different political pundits and such that have said it comes down to small, minute categories, like you're saying, small, like blacks. What percentage of blacks are going to vote? So really, the election, more or less, is going to come down to, is 20% of the blacks going to vote for Trump, or are only 10% going to vote for Trump? And that the election pretty much lives or dies on something as minute or as categorized as that. Is that kind of accurate? Do you kind of look at it that way?
Okay. No, I mean, there are two different issues. One issue is what percent of voters will be black. That's a lot more difficult than to go and try to figure out whether it's going to be 20% or 10% of blacks that are going to be voting. Because they can see whether somebody's a black in their sample. And they can go and see, you know, 20% of the blacks that we surveyed said that they're going to vote for Trump. That's an easier question than going and trying to answer, you know, what percent of voters are going to be black. And we can look at past elections to try to figure those things out. But I think things change a lot, you know, just the intensity. And they can try to guess what percent, but they can go and ask blacks, are you following the election closely? Have you voted in the past? Are you likely to vote in the future? They can ask them questions, and they can use those answers to try to calibrate these things. But there's, you know, it's still, it's not
black and white.
Perfectly precise.
Yeah, it's not black and white, which we sometimes think that it is. Okay, let me ask you this question. How did an economist like you are start doing research on gun crimes? It's kind of a weird connection.
Yeah, I have a PhD in economics. I've taught at a lot of universities. I was chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission in Washington for a couple years.
What does that mean?
Basically,
what does that mean, the Sentencing Commission?
Well, the Sentencing Commission is the organization that sets the penalties for all federal crimes. So if you go and make $0 in gains from illegal trades, from insider trading, you'll go to jail for 4 to 10 months. If you make $250, you'll go to jail for 6 to 12 months, and so on. And the Sentencing Commission is the one that set up the rules there that the courts generally try to follow. You know, saying if you commit a certain crime, here's how long you can expect to be in prison. And an economist looks at things like, what's the harm from the crime, trying to measure that. They try to look at things like, what's the likelihood you're going to catch a criminal who commits a crime. So if the notion is that the criminal penalties are supposed to be related to the harm, they also have to be related to the probability you're going to catch somebody. Let me give you an example. If I go and throw a gallon of oil off the side of my boat, the chances I'm going to get caught are really tiny. But if I have something like the Exxon Valdez that goes and runs aground someplace, I'm going to get caught with certainty. It's not like I can go and say, well, that's not my boat that's there.
No.
And I will take into account the fact that it's very easy to hide the first crime that's there in determining what the penalties are. I'm going to have a much bigger penalty relative to the harm if I'm almost never going to catch somebody in order to try to discourage them from committing the harm that's there than if I'm going to catch you with certainty. And so economists are involved in this. But look, the basic issue is this. Economics has a couple of main points to it. One of the points is that if something's more costly, people do less of it. And that's true for buying apples. If the price of apple goes up, people buy fewer apples. It's also true for criminals committing crimes. If you make crime riskier for criminals, make it more costly, increase the arrest rate, increase the prison sentence, have the death penalty, have other things like that, you will be more likely to discourage criminals from committing crimes. But just as you can discourage criminals for committing crimes with higher arrest rates or longer sentences, you can also discourage them from committing crimes if you let victims defend themselves, because letting victims defend themselves can also make it riskier for criminals to go and commit crimes. And so those are, you know, gun ownership is one way you let people defend themselves.
You've written a book called Gun Control Myths. I'm very excited to hear about this. I'm sure people can find it on Amazon or wherever, crime research,
right,
at your website. Gun Control Myths. Let's talk about it. What are some gun control myths?
Right. Well, the book is my latest one. It's been out for a month or so. I think it's probably one of my best. I wrote it in part for the election that's coming up because there's so many claims that people hear about in the media. And it goes through 36 different types of myths that we frequently hear in the media. So, you know, looking at mass public shootings, for example, which I think drives a lot of the gun control debate, you know, I point out that about 94% of these mass public shootings occur in places where guns are banned, that these killers purposely, I mean, at least the successful ones, are maybe crazy, but they're not stupid. They know if they go to a place where victims aren't able to go and defend themselves, they're going to be able to go and kill more people and get more media attention. I go through and talk about the mass public shootings that are stopped by people with permanent concealed handguns in places where they are able to use it, and how the media, I mean, you literally have dozens of cases in the last few years, and how the media just doesn't cover these things. And, you know, my guess is the whole gun control debate would be dramatically different if just once in a while the media would mention that for the successful attacks, they keep on occurring in places where guns are banned, and would go and talk about the other cases where people use guns to stop the attacks. I have a discussion in there about guns and suicides. You know, there are places in the United States and around the world which have banned handguns or all guns. You would think if the claim is right that gun ownership somehow makes suicides more likely, you would see drops in suicide rates when guns are banned. In fact, there's no change, no statistically significant change. People just go and switch to other ways, which are about as equally successful in committing suicides. You know, I talk about things like what's the most successful way for people to defend themselves when they're confronted by a criminal. I have issues in there about what research shows. You know, a lot of the media is gives people a really misimpression about what academic research has found on guns. You know, another thing.
Like
on
what? Like an example. Like an example.
Well, I mean, there's three main types of researchers out there. You have criminologists, economists, and public health people. Criminologists and economists are very skeptical of gun control working. If you look at those two groups in talking about mass public shootings, they overwhelmingly believe that the most important proposal to have is to get rid of gun-free zones. Public health people, that's the last thing that they want to do. And yet 94% of the money that the federal government gives out for firearms research goes to public health people, not to criminologists, not to economists. These are the same people. And that's, if you look at the media coverage, the media gives almost exclusive coverage to studies by public health people and not to criminologists who you think, you know, you would be likely to listen to when it comes to studies on crime. Public health people, you know, I could go, I wrote another book on their research, The War on Guns. You know, it's really poorly done research that's there. I mean, these are the same people who are putting together the estimates on the number of people who would die or get the coronavirus. They're about as accurate in their work on guns as they've been on that. So, but, you know, I think the reason why Democrats, when they say we want to talk about guns as a public health issue, they go and give money to the people who they think are going to.
Wow, I didn't think about it that way. Because you hear that. There's the music. We're on a break. You know, you hear that. Hey, we need more public health research on that. I never even put those two together. You've made this perfectly clear why that happens. Dr. John Locke, crimeresearch.org is the website, crimeresearch.org. Gun Control Myths is his new book. He's written a lot of things. This guy's no joke. We're really excited to have him, and as you can hear, well worth your time. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Power Hour.
Break the bond to Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
What in the world is this crazy Willard water?
It's a proprietary solution, and it's a water additive that was invented by my grandfather, Dr. John Willard, and hence the name Willard Water. Boosts a number of different things. We see most prominently that it's increasing the absorption, utilization, and storage of nutrients in the cells. So, for example, if people were drinking, we see a big boost in B vitamin absorption, utilization. If you see it in plants, we see a big boost in their ability to absorb and retain fertilizers or nutrients in the soil. So we see with things like microbes. If you used a microbe on soil, for example, to replenish the soil, and you sprayed our Willard water on it, go through that replenishing cycle much faster.
Call 1-877
1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
If you eat your man of food on a semi-regular basis, you're probably getting better quality food and healthier for your body than you're eating now.
Your products are GMO-free. There's no added MSG and no chemical preservatives or high fructose corn syrup. And you also have gluten-free products as well.
We have a great variety of very high-quality products.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have flash sales of the REM Sleep, the REM Sleep, the Tranquil, the Power Silver, which we talked about last hour. We have the DuraFlow filters over there, too. They fit in. If you have a Berkey water system, they fit in that, or Aquarain. They're kind of universal. Those, all those type filters kind of fit. It's just a totally different way of doing it over at the Power Mall. Of course, the Strauss products, the Heart Drops, Smooth Oregano, and Cold Storm is also available from Strauss. The CardioCom and the Kidney Support, all fantastic, world-class. Some of the most profound products, the Heart Drops, the most profound product we have ever had at the Power Mall. The Iron Earth to remineralize your soil. At the end of the year, you can put it in there, and then in the spring, boom, everything will be ready. It takes, you know, those, the type of thing, it takes a couple seasons to really go in. The ancient minerals, the lotion from Robert Redfern, among other things. Maxi Focus for your eyes. We apologize for the eye complex. We haven't been able to get it, haven't been able to be manufactured. The Maxi Focus is a good replacement from Robert Redfern also. It's fantastic. And also a t-shirt. And I have one of the t-shirts on now. They look fantastic. They're a great conversation starter. So check it out at thepowermall.com, thepowermall.com, 877-817-9829. You should know it by heart by now. And we're getting back to our guest, Dr. John Lott. He is well known throughout the country as doing the different research that he does, economist researching guns, which I thought was so ironic. To see that, but you can understand why now listening to him. CrimeResearch.org is his website. His new book, Gun Control Myths, among other things. He's written a lot. He writes a lot in different publications. You can check him out. CrimeResearch.org is his website. Dr. Lott, before the break, we were talking about, this kind of, war on guns. That's one of your books you've written, and that's a good way to put it, is that the money is being funneled into the one type of research that is disproportionately against guns, it seems like. I mean, at your level, at your realm, is this like a joke? Kind of like, how in the world are they coming up with this research about the guns? Or what goes through your mind when you see public health side being so skewed against guns?
Well, I mean, it's just not the federal money. People look at Michael Bloomberg. I mean, he's just announced $100 million at least that he's going to be spending only on Florida, just Florida alone, to help Biden get elected. He's probably spending another $500 million across the rest of the country. He spends $60 million a year on every town, $60 million a year, I guess, on Moms Demand Action. He spends tons of money on other things. But what people don't know is that he also spends hundreds of millions of dollars on financing this public health research. And, Bloomberg's a pretty smart guy. He knows that you just can't win the gun control debate if you just do things, in terms of politics. He wants to fundamentally change people's views on guns. And he knows that when his studies come out, they get completely uncritical news coverage. I mean, the bizarre thing is there are people who work for Michael Bloomberg's organizations. Like, he has this one organization called The Trace, which is a media outlet. And they provide people who work for them write articles for every place from Scientific American to National Public Radio to Salon and many other organizations. And, they're published as a Scientific American article. I mean, could you imagine Scientific American having NRA employees going and writing articles as Scientific American articles? I mean, at least you would think that they would acknowledge that that these people are working for Bloomberg. When I've talked to the editors at these places, they say, "Well, Bloomberg's, he's an objective guy, and he
objective.
I don't even know how they say these things with a straight face, but it's just." He obviously has a strong point of view. The people who work for him have a strong point of view. And if they didn't share his view, he wouldn't be hiring him. He wouldn't be working for his gun control organizations if they had a different view.
You mentioned that his goal is to change the perception of guns in America. Is it working?
Well, I think it's had a big impact. I mean, I think, look, when he publishes gets these studies out, they get uncritical news coverage. And so people hear news story after news story about how some new study has shown that more guns lead to more suicide or more guns lead to more, shootings or something like that. And, I think it's wrong. I just give you a simple fact, and that is, We talked before about places that have banned guns, either all guns or all handguns. Every single place that's banned either all guns or all handguns, not just places in the United States like Chicago and Washington, D.C. when they had those bans, but any place in the world, has seen an increase in homicide and murder rates. You'd think out of randomness there'd be one place where there's been a gun ban where murder rates had gone down or at least stayed the same. But in fact, every single time they go up, and often by very large amounts. And there's a simple reason for that, and that is when you ban guns, it's the most law-abiding good citizens who turn in their guns, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you see increases in crime because it's easier for the criminals to go and commit crime. In an era where police are being ordered to stand down and you have defunding of the police and releasing prisoners in massive numbers from jails and prisons across the United States because of the coronavirus, people realize more than normal that they have to have the ability to go and protect themselves. Anybody who's read my academic research knows that I think police are extremely important. I think they're the single most important factor for reducing crime. But the police themselves are very strongly supportive of, on average, of private ownership of guns because they themselves realize that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And they see for themselves how important it is to be able to have guns to protect themselves when you know, they're having to confront criminals themselves. So they understand firsthand why it's important for people to own guns.
In my own life, you know, the people I'm around, I have a brother-in-law, and I'll get to a point here in a second, but my own brother-in-law is very democratic, very liberal, extremely used to hate guns, used to be, you know, basically Biden-Harris ticket is right up his alley. Here lately, with everything that's gone on, everything you mentioned, Portland, the rioting, the what have you, I was shocked. My jaw almost hit the floor when he said at the last family outing, yeah, I'm thinking about buying a gun. I want to get a gun. I'm like, right. What? I couldn't believe. I mean, is this just my family and just my brother-in-law? Or it almost seems like all the unrest is actually changing people want to buy more guns.
Right. Well, I mean, we've had record gun sales this year. Through the first 8 months or so of this year, we've sold more guns, or more guns have been sold than in any previous year that we've had records for. And a lot of those are new purchases. Of course, now it's very difficult to go and buy a lot of different types of guns in gun stores because the manufacturers haven't been able to keep up production to match the demand, and it's essentially impossible to go and buy ammunition there. But look, you know, it's a combination of things. It's the fact that police haven't been able to respond, but you also have the fact, I think, people beginning to focus on the fact that this election could very quickly determine whether or not people are going to be able to go and buy guns. I mean, you just had this series of tweets that Biden put out on Sunday. So on Saturday, you had those sheriff's deputies in Los Angeles were brutally shot. Maybe people have seen the video of that, where this person came up to the side of their police vehicle and shot the two young officers that were there. Biden tweeted out in reaction to that we have to get rid of weapons of war. Now, normally, they're talking about AR-15s or something. We can talk about that in a second. This attack involved a handgun. So I don't know if Biden now is including bans on all handguns. It's not even clear whether the person used a revolver or used a semi-automatic handgun. But, you know, the general point, you know, in the Democratic platform or Biden or Harris, I mean, both of them have talked about buybacks. Harris has talked about a mandatory buyback using executive orders for the president to do this. You know, an AR-15 may look like an M16 type weapon, but it is a semi-automatic gun. It functions the same as any semi-automatic hunting rifle. One pull of the trigger, one bullet comes out. You know, it fires the same bullets as a small caliber hunting rifle. In fact, the .22-3 caliber bullet isn't even allowed for hunting deer in most states because the commissions in the different states are worried that you're more likely to wound than to kill the deer, and they don't want a wounded deer running off and suffering and pain. You know, if you want to go and ban all semi-automatic guns, at least there might be some logic to it. And most guns in the United States are semi-automatics. The vast majority are semi-automatics. But to go and ban some semi-automatic guns based on how they look rather than how they function doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, you have one semi-automatic rifle that looks like an M16, but it's, you know, they may talk about weapons of war as Biden did on Sunday, but there's no military in the world that uses these semi-automatic rifles. You know, the regular military rifles have either kind of machine gun burst modes where one pull of the trigger has multiple bullets come out, or, you know, pure fully automatic, which one pull of the trigger, bullets will come out as long as you have the trigger depressed. Whereas these semi-automatics, one pull of the trigger, one bullet comes out, it reloads itself, one pull of the trigger, one bullet comes out, and so on.
Let me interject. You're listening to everything you said today, and you are a world-class researcher on so many levels. And we hear this, oh, trust science, And I'm listening to you and think, well, you trust science depending on who's funding the research or depends on who's, I mean, how am I supposed to have confidence in this? It seems like a coordinated effort with the media, like the researcher and the media. And if they have an agenda, if they have an angle, it will all work in the same direction if there's enough money behind it, and science be damned. That's what I'm hearing from you.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I've been discouraged by the media for a number of years. You know, I think people have some idea now just listening to the coverage of Trump. Maybe he has kind of made the media have to become more public in terms of their biases that are there. But mm-hmm. on issues like guns, they've always been very biased. You know,
why do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
You know, I mean, most people on the media are liberals, and I think if there's one issue, at least according to surveys, that most differentiates liberals and conservatives, it's the issue of gun control. You know, you want to ask, well, why do liberals have the views that they do compared to conservatives? I suppose, this is just conjecture, but I think the big difference is who do you trust? So let's take something like Obamacare. Obamacare has very strict rules on what insurance companies can offer for health care. You know, the notion is that they don't trust individuals to decide what's covered. Basically, the only choices you have under Obamacare is the size of the deductible that you're going to have. You know, whether you get covered, you know, so my wife can be 64. She's unlikely to have another child, but she's still covered for childbirth. But they don't give you the choice on what you have covered or not. If you don't trust people to decide what type of things are going to be covered by your health insurance, how are you going to trust them for, owning a gun? I mean, in some sense, owning a weapon is the ultimate question in terms of whether you trust individuals or not. And it's not too surprising to me that liberals don't trust individuals to make decisions. They trust themselves or people they regard as experts or the government. You know, the irony is now, if you look at the Bloomberg groups, they've been attacking the notion of even police having guns. Bloomberg's Trace and his gun control groups have been calling for the disarmament of police officers recently in the last few months with the riots and stuff that have, you know, kind of moved into the defunding of the police. And, I have a hard time wrapping my head around the notion that anybody could think that disarming the police would be a useful approach to dealing with crime. But, you know, the notion that somehow you're going to, I mean, here's the deal. The major source of illegal guns in the United States are drug dealers. You know, it's not like a drug dealer can go to the police and say, look, this other dealer stole my drugs. Can you help us get them back? They have to set up their own little militaries in order to protect that very valuable property that they have. And so just as they have drugs there, they have weapons, and they sell both. And so the notion that you're going to be able to go and stop criminals from getting guns, you know, you're going to be as successful in doing that, basically, as you are stopping them from buying illegal drugs. You know, if you want to have an idea of what it's like, go look at Mexico. Mexico, since 1972, has had only one gun store in the country. It's located in Mexico City. You have to pay a $2,100 fee to go and get a license. You have way less than 1%. It's like a tenth of 1% of the adult population is legally licensed to own a gun. The most powerful gun that you've been able to buy legally in Mexico since 1972 is a .22 caliber short round rifle. And yet Mexico regularly has a murder rate that's more than six times higher than the murder rate that we have in the United States. Drug gangs bring in weapons from around the world, just as they bring in the drugs. You know, in a recent five-year period, the Mexican government confiscated 13,000 hand grenades from drug gangs there. They don't go to U.S. gun stores and buy hand grenades. they bring them in from around the world just as they bring in the other weapons that they have.
I'm listening to you, and it was interesting from an economic, from a research point of view. You were kind of coming to the same conclusion that the Founding Fathers did. The Founding Father, Thomas Jefferson, talked about guns, George Washington. That really is the foundation of America. Britain was going to take our guns, and we said, no, you're not. And I'm of the opinion that guns are as American as apple pie and mom. That is the American ideal. What is the ideal? That you are in charge of yourself, you can own a gun, and that you can be responsible. Chairman Mao said that political power comes at the point of a gun. So where is the political power in America? It's a, you can hold a gun. You have the power. And if you don't, then you give the power to somebody else. It's interesting from a theoretical, political standpoint, and now a research standpoint. It's kind of those ideas I see them merging and listening to you.
Well, I try to stay away from the political theory stuff that you're going through there. I mean, to me, I focus on crime, per se. And it's just, my views have changed a lot over time on this.
How?
When I worked at the Sentencing Commission and the research that I did at that time, I was not really interested in the gun issue at all. When I was teaching at Wharton, the Wharton Business School, I made the mistake of telling one of my classes that we were ahead in the syllabus. And I had a couple students come up to me after class, and they said, well, you know, it's not really on top point for the class. We're dealing with white-collar and corporate crime mainly. They said, but if I had some time, since we're ahead in the syllabus, could I talk a little bit about gun control? And I said, well, I guess I can do that. It kind of forced me to read through more of the academic literature, and I have to say, I'd read some papers in the area, but I thought they were pretty stupid. I just assumed that there were other better done papers out there. But when it forced me to go through the literature, I was pretty shocked by how poorly done the existing research was. You had very small studies. You know, somebody would pick 13 counties from the United States or 30 counties from the United States. I don't know how you pick 30 counties from 3,140 counties. None of the previous studies had tried to account for the impact of law enforcement on crime rates. I don't even, you know, it seems to me, as I just said a few minutes ago, police, I think, are the single most important factor for reducing crime. And so not controlling for their impact at all just seemed bizarre to me. But anyway, when you're an academic, one of the reasons why you do research is so you think you can do a better job than others have done. That's not normally what's motivated me, but, you know, I started working on it and almost stopped about six different times, but I collected all the data for all the counties in the United States over all the years that the data was available. And I finished a paper, and I got a call from a reporter named Dennis Couchon, who worked at USA Today. I'd gotten to know Dennis when I was chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission. He'd call me up every 6 months or so asking me questions on some, you know, article that he was writing. And so anyway, he asked me his questions, and at the end of the conversation, he said, well, what are you working on? I said, well, I just finished this paper on gun control. He said, well, that sounds interesting. Why don't I send it to him? So I did. And a week later, it was on the front page of USA Today. And we were kind of off to the races at that point. But my views, I was pretty much in the middle of the debate before I started to do this work. I got stuck in it in part because just kind of there are a lot of attacks on my work. And also, the thing that kind of amazed me and has kind of culminated in this new book that I just have, Gun Control Myths, is I'm just stunned by the amount of misinformation that's out there. I've been involved in a lot of academic debates over the years, but I've never seen anywhere near as much information, misinformation, as we see on the gun issue. And I guess I kind of convinced myself if I hadn't tried to do this, nobody would. And it's been costly in terms of my academic career. But
why has it been costly? Have you been ostracized because of this? People don't like your opinion or don't like your research?
Politicians. So when I was at the University of Chicago, My book came out in May 1998, More Guns, Less Crime. In November 1998, Mayor Daley, Mayor Richard Daley, who was the mayor of Chicago, called up the president of the University of Chicago and went through for 40 minutes or so all the wonderful things that the city wanted to do with the school. But then at the end of the conversation, he said my continued presence at the university was going to do, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, to the relationship between the city and the school.
Wow.
And he basically demanded that they remove me from the faculty. And so anyway, I won't go through the whole story there. But and then I went to Yale. And the second year I was at Yale, I was asked by state legislators in Hawaii to come and testify there. And I went out. They were talking about changes in the registration and licensing laws in the state that they had had since 1960. And I had, before I went there, I said, look, the Honolulu police chief is going to be testifying the other side. We don't want to sandbag him. We want to go and let him know in advance two questions that I recommend that you ask him. One is, how many crimes a year have they been able to solve as a result of registration and licensing? And the second question is, how much does it cost each year to go and run the program? I knew the answers in advance, but I wanted the police chief to have the time to go and check this. And he came back and he said that there were zero crimes that they'd been able to find that they had solved as a result of licensing and registration, and it cost about 50,000 hours of police time each year to go and run the program. And so anyway, when I got back to Yale, the two U.S. senators from Hawaii had called up the dean's office there and were upset that I had basically
Dr. Lott, we got 15 seconds. Yeah, we got 15 seconds. I just had to let that story go. My God. Dr. John Lott, crimeresearch.org. Fantastic gun control myth. Check it out. It's well worth your time. Unbelievable sources, you can tell. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Stay right there, John Lott. We'll see you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Power Hour.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiatics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Foods, Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.